The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Dr. Scott Youngkin for the North Carolina Reading Service. And this is Health Issues for the next half hour. I'm going to be reading articles from the Mayo Clinic Health Letter. And the first article is an article about diabetes technology. Treatments pumped up with new tech. From clip-on gadgets to smartphone apps, tools to manage diabetes have come a long way since the first blood glucose meter was introduced in 1970. For people who monitor their blood sugar regularly and need multiple daily injections of insulin, technology can make life a little easier. Today's devices are convenient to use and can help simplify treatment regimens, which can lead to fewer disease complications and an improved quality of life. Within the wide array of choices available are glucose sensors that continuously monitor blood sugar levels without a finger stick, insulin pump devices that more seamlessly deliver insulin when needed with less need for injections, and systems that can integrate both blood sugar monitoring and insulin delivery. While these advances have been helpful to many people living with diabetes, there are a few factors to consider before diving in. The basics. Diabetes mellitus refers to a group of diseases that affect how the body uses blood sugar, or glucose. Glucose is vital to your health because it's an important source of energy for the cells that make up your muscles and your tissues. It's also your brain's main source of fuel. The underlying cause of diabetes varies by type, but no matter what type of diabetes you have, it can lead to excess sugar in your blood. Living with diabetes often requires a blood glucose meter to measure and display your current blood sugar. You're probably familiar with the traditional models that require a finger stick and a drop of blood to determine your blood sugar levels at the moment. There also are diabetes tools that monitor blood sugar continuously through a sensor placed under your skin. These continuous glucose monitors, or CGMs, may be used alongside insulin delivery tools like traditional vials with syringes, pumps, pens, or smart pen devices that help calculate and track doses. All current CGM manufacturers recommend that you continue to have a traditional glucose meter for safety. This is due to the possible lag time between blood glucose levels taken with a finger stick and the sensor glucose value taken by the CGM system. The difference in these values can depend on a number of factors. Your diabetes care team can provide you with any needed education. Some insulin pumps and sensor systems can work together to allow for automatic delivery of extra insulin, as well as temporary changes in insulin delivery ranging from a full suspension of insulin to an increased dose. All of these functions are based on predicted blood sugar fluctuations and the equation used to help keep levels balanced. When deciding whether technology may benefit you, consider your current routine, your needs and abilities. Think about hypoglycemic episodes. Do you have frequent low blood sugar or hypoglycemia episodes? If it's a challenge to keep blood sugar levels within your target range, you may benefit from continuous monitoring technology with customizable safeguards and real-time data features. Another thing to think about is lifestyle. Are you looking for greater flexibility in insulin dosing that doesn't interfere with your lifestyle? Technology that provides customizable and dynamic dosing may be a good option. In addition to insulin pumps, smart insulin pens and smartphone apps can allow for this increased flexibility in your management plan. You should also think about cost. Diabetes management devices can be expensive and aren't always covered by insurance. This makes cost a consideration, of course. There are a range of price options on the market, including free smartphone apps. So ask your diabetes care team to help you to find the right fit. Think about individual needs. Are there special considerations in your diabetes health picture, like episodes of high blood sugar in the early morning that require an insulin adjustment, a pump and sensor system that can automatically adjust insulin delivery during this time is a possible solution? Do you have vision problems or challenges with fine hand movements? A technology tool or two may assist you further in living well with diabetes. Think about whether you're tech savvy. Learning to use a device does take some time and patience, especially if you haven't had a lot of exposure to technology. Are you comfortable troubleshooting problems and resources in navigating the various diabetes management tools? Are you willing to learn how to use new technology and adjust to it? Depending on your circumstances, simpler tools without all the bells and whistles may be all you need. Regardless of the type and level of technology, professional education and continued support are often a key to your success. Whether you're newly diagnosed or have been using insulin therapy for years, it's a balancing act to keep your blood glucose in the target range 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Technology tools dedicated to diabetes management typically fall into two categories: devices that help you monitor your blood sugar and devices that deliver insulin. There's also the ability to combine these various tools into systems that communicate and function together. With your diabetes care team, you can determine whether combining one or more of these technologies might benefit your management plan. The article has a side light that talks about some other issues. One of the things it talks about is the smart insulin pen. The smart insulin pen is about the size of a large ink pen and features a needle, a cartridge that holds insulin, a dosage dial, and a button that administers the insulin. It connects wirelessly to a smartphone app to record information like insulin dose and time, active insulin tracking, and glucose data. It can also help with dose reminders, mealtime dosing calculations, temperature gauging, and assessments to share with your care team. The insulin smart pen allows for similar dosing calculation to an insulin pump without being continuously attached to the body. The insulin smart pen can be a great way to build knowledge and comfort before adding other types of diabetes tech. The pen can still be used as a standard insulin delivery device if you lose your phone. One consideration is that every injection requires a new needle. The article also talks about continuous glucose monitors. Continuous glucose monitors are typically placed on the abdomen, the low back, or the back of the arm. And they have a sensor that's inserted into the fat tissue under the skin and a transmitter that relays blood sugar every few minutes. A receiver device displays the current and recent glucose readings, and an arrow predicts whether glucose levels will be likely to go up or down. Many CGMs continuously report blood sugar levels on a receiver, an insulin pump, a phone, or a smartwatch. Some allow real-time sharing of data. Some drugs like acetaminophen, albuterol, and lisinopril may interfere with the accuracy of some CGMs. Also adjacent to this article is an article that's entitled Dealing with Your Grandchild's Diagnosis. When a grandchild receives a serious diagnosis like a developmental disability, a chronic condition, or an illness like cancer, you might not know how to help. Here's some things you can think about. One is babysitting. Watch the child or their siblings while the parents are in appointments, or provide money for a respite service. Also, you can help with household tasks. Make meals, mow the lawn, help with homework, drive siblings to activities, or pay for a monthly cleaning service. You should also know when to talk and when to listen. Refrain from offering unsolicited suggestions for treatments or therapies. Some parents may find relief in talking about other topics, like current events. Others may appreciate you just remaining silent. You can sit in on appointments. Help listen to the doctor and ask questions and take notes. You can tend to the siblings. Schedule one-on-one quality time with all the grandchildren, not just the one with the diagnosis. This can help the siblings feel more secure and may stop them from misbehaving to get attention. You can rely on routine. Routines are often comforting to children, so don't change your usual activities and discipline unless there are practical reasons to do so. Also, you can have fun. No matter the diagnosis, your grandkid needs to have fun. Go to the zoo, stream a silly TV show, play games. If you're feeling overwhelmed, be sure to take care of yourself. Next in the Mayo Clinic Health Letter is an article on nasal polyps, a problem that grows in your nose. You may know that abnormal growths known as polyps can occur in the colon and the uterus. Did you know that polyps can grow in your nose? While colon and uterine polyps can lead to cancer, nasal polyps are soft, painless, and non-cancerous. So, what's the problem? Sometimes nasal polyps don't cause problems. You may not even realize you have them, and they don't require any treatment. But if they grow large enough, they can block your nasal passages, making it hard to smell or breathe through your nose, and otherwise be disruptive. It's not clear what precisely causes nasal polyps, but they occur in people with chronic inflammation of the lining of the nose and sinus. Polyps are associated with asthma, respiratory allergies, chronic sinus problems, and aspirin-exacerbated respiratory disease. Nasal polyps hang down and look like grayish teardrops or small grapes. They can appear at one or both sides of the nose or the sinuses. Polyps can cause difficulty with breathing through your nose and with smelling. They can also lead to sensations of fullness or pressure in your face. Polyps may cause mucus to drain down your throat, or a frequent urge to clear your throat or cough. Your healthcare provider may be able to see the polyps by just looking up your nose with a light. A CT scan can provide more information, as can nasal endoscopy. In an endoscopy, a small tube with a camera is inserted in your nose to provide details about the number and location of polyps and to find polyps that are deeper in the sinuses. Large nasal polyps can be shrunk with medications, or they can be surgically removed. Medication options that may be recommended include corticosteroids. Nasal and oral corticosteroids can shrink polyps. Nasal corticosteroid sprays are typically the first choice, but sometimes they don't work, or they can't easily be used if a large polyp blocks you from delivering a nasal medication. Oral corticosteroids are typically taken only for about 1 to 3 weeks in order to prevent the risk of more serious side effects like a weakened immune system, osteoporosis, or cataracts. Monoclonal antibody therapy. Injected medications known as biologics can help certain people with nasal polyps. These drugs include dupilumab or Dupixent, mepolizumab or Nucala, and omalizumab or Xolair. They work by limiting inflammation in the nasal and sinus areas, but they can be very expensive and may be recommended only if other treatments don't provide enough relief. For some people, surgery to remove the polyps is a consideration. This can be done by placing an endoscope, a small tube with a camera and a cutting tool, like a micro debrider, up the nostril. A surgeon can also enlarge the openings of the sinuses to help improve the flow of mucus and allow better access for nasal medication. Functional endoscopic sinus surgery, or FESS, removes inflamed nasal tissue and bony walls within the sinuses to create wider sinus openings. FESS generally requires general anesthesia. Sometimes a small device called a steroid eluting stent is placed in the sinuses during surgery to deliver steroids to the tissue. These stents may dissolve or be removed endoscopically during a follow-up appointment. Unfortunately, nasal polyps commonly come back. One study found that after surgical removal, polyps return about 40% of the time within a year and a half. Using nasal corticosteroid sprays or rinses long-term after surgery may help to stop the polyps from returning. The next section in the August 2022 Mayo Clinic Health Letter is called News and Our Views. The first article is entitled Heart Disease, Memory Loss Linked More in Women. It's long been understood that people with heart disease and related risk factors in midlife are at higher risk of developing dementia and other conditions related to memory loss. A recent Mayo Clinic study found that while men and women are both at risk, the risk is higher in women. This research was published in the journal Neurology and looked at over 1,800 people ages 50 to 69 enrolled in the Mayo Clinic study of aging. Half were men and half were women. Over a 3-year period, participants were tested every 15 months on a range of memory and cognitive tasks. They were also evaluated for heart disease. The evaluation included coronary artery disease, heart rhythm problems, and congestive heart failure. It also included conditions that increase heart disease risk, like diabetes, stroke, and high blood pressure. 83% of the men and 75% of the women in the study had at least one cardiovascular condition or risk factor for cardiovascular disease. More women than men were affected by memory lapses and other cognitive issues. That was true for women with high cholesterol and diabetes, and especially for those with coronary artery disease. Their scores on cognitive tasks declined at twice the rate of men. There was one related condition that bucked the trend, congestive heart failure. with congestive heart failure, cognitive function in men, especially their language function, decline more than in women. Mayo Clinic experts say that the findings stress the need for awareness and testing for heart and circulatory system conditions, particularly for people who smoke, are overweight, or have a family history of diabetes or high blood pressure. Taking steps to lower your risk, like stopping smoking, eating a heart-healthy diet, exercising daily, and seeing your care provider for regular checkups, can ultimately benefit both your heart and your mind. The next section in news and our views from the August issue of the Mayo Clinic Health Letter is entitled, Low Back Pain, Aquatic Exercises May Help. When done correctly, water workouts give benefits similar to workouts on land, including gains in aerobic fitness, muscle strength and endurance, flexibility and balance. Now, a recent study in JAMA Network Open adds another to the list, reduced back pain. 113 participants with chronic low back pain were randomly assigned to either a therapeutic water exercise group or physical therapy treatments for 12 weeks. Researchers then followed up with the participants for 12 months. Results at the end of the 12-week programs showed a difference. The water group reported greater improvement in pain intensity, function, quality of life, sleep quality, and fear and avoidance of exercise. These improvements were still seen at the one-year mark. Previous studies have touted the benefits of water workouts, particularly for those who have pain, mobility issues, or a fear of falling. Water is gentle on the body and provides support. Additionally, water resistance slows movement, improving the workout. Mayo Clinic experts recommend starting slow if you're new to aquatic exercise. You might start with water walking. Avoid walking on your tiptoes and keep your back straight. Tighten your abdominal muscles to avoid leaning too far forward or to the side. Water shoes can help you maintain traction on the bottom of the pool. If you want a more intense workout, wear hand webs or other devices to increase resistance as you move through the water. Now I'm going to read an article that's called Kids with Autism. How to be supportive. Jenny always behaved a little differently from your other grandchildren. As a baby, you noticed that she didn't make eye contact or giggle as much as her cousins. As a toddler, she would get very upset if anyone tried to change her routine. Her parents just called with an explanation for her differences, a diagnosis of autism spectrum disorder. Autism spectrum disorder is a brain development disorder that affects the ability to communicate and interact with others. Symptoms include avoiding eye contact, not understanding body language, and having difficulty speaking or participating in conversation. Autism also results in limited, repetitive patterns of behavior, interests, or activities. These can include the need for strict routine, or result in motions like rocking or spinning. Children with more obvious symptoms may be diagnosed with autism spectrum disorder, but others may not be diagnosed until later. If you have a grandchild or another relative with autism spectrum disorder, you may have a lot of questions. Autism isn't necessarily occurring more frequently, it's just better recognized. With increased media coverage and awareness, it's likely that you're hearing about autism more than ever. Is something causing cases to rise? It's true that estimates of children with autism have gone up. The CDC estimated in 2000 that 1 in 150 children was autistic, compared with 1 in 44 in 2018. But this rise in numbers is believed to be at least partly attributed to new ways of defining autism, as well as better awareness, screening, and understanding of the disorder. When autism was first defined, the diagnostic criteria were very strict. In 2013, several disorders, including autism and Asperger's syndrome, were collapsed under the term autism spectrum disorder. This better reflects the idea that people with the disorder can display many different behaviors. Note, autism is not caused by vaccination. In 1998, a very small study of 12 children claimed to show a connection between the measles, mumps, rubella vaccine and autism. But there were many errors in the study design. The study was retracted. Extensive research since then has shown no connection between childhood vaccines and autism. In 2019, a study of 600,000 Danish children found that even among children at higher risk of autism, the MMR vaccine did not lead to more autism diagnoses. There are probably various interacting causes. Genes and environmental factors, such as using certain medications during pregnancy and exposure to air pollutants, may play important roles. Groups that may be at higher risk of autism include boys, people with a family history of autism, babies born to older parents, and babies born before 26 weeks of pregnancy. Well, it looks like we've run out of time for today's episode of Health Issues. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you enjoyed it. I'm Dr. Scott Youngkin, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Health Issues is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. That's ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thanks for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service. Thank you.